Thank you, Lorelei. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and I hope that this will be a fruitful time for you. Just to have the end resemble the beginning, I'd like to point out some things I think you've picked up, and one is a commercial. We have something in Dearborn called the Worldview Seminar. It was a post 9/11 initiative of the Episcopal Church, and it's taken on legs of its own. The University of Michigan has embraced it. A multi-faith committee plans it. I show up and teach it, and we rent a bus for the week, 5.5 days, 8:30 in the morning to 8:30 at night. Crash course in America's religious diversity. We learn about who is around us. We then spend a portion of each day taking that bus to one or more field sites that have been researched by the University of Michigan's Center for the Study of Religion and Society. It's so much fun, and it would be so much fun to have people from beyond Michigan and its immediate neighbors join us this summer. So think about it, or think about somebody in your constituency who might benefit by such an engagement. There's a flyer about it, and I'd love to talk to you about it. But it's one of the most fun things I do. The other fun things that I do is to get to work and teach in a number of multi-religious contexts. And so I hope over lunch that maybe we can engage on some of the other aspects of my work. But today we're going to focus mostly on this document, A Common Word. It was 2007, and the Muslim holiday known as Eid al-Fitr when this document was promulgated. It's called A Common Word Between Us and You, an open letter and call from Muslim religious leaders to leaders of Christian churches everywhere. In this workshop, I'd like to place that document in context, share some recent assessments with you, and that means there's one more thing I need to pull out of here. Yep, there it is. Good. Okay, and consider some possible ways forward and how to make use of this document. I've been asked, well, where did it start? You know, who thought up the idea of having such a document be issued? And as best I can tell, its author, it's or at least the person who launched the idea that such a document needed to be written was His Royal Highness Prince Ghazi bin Mohammed of Jordan. The initiative comes out of Jordan, but it then engaged scholars, muftis from Egypt, Mauritania, Syria, Bosnia, Yemen, one of the famous Shia ayatollahs was asked also to be on the vetting committee, and a British scholar, Tim Winter, who's a convert to Islam, and the another Shia scholar, Sayyid Hossein Nasra, who teaches in D.C., these people, about a dozen of them, vetted the document before it was promulgated. While it was addressed to Christian leaders of church, or leaders of Christian churches everywhere, it's important to recollect that the primary addressee and the first recipient was Pope Benedict XVI. Why? Because on September 13, 2006, the Pope had given an address in Regensburg, Germany, in which he had included some controversial remarks vis-a-vis Islam. Exactly 1 month later, October 13, 2006, 38 Islamic authorities and scholars from around the world, representing the range of Islam's branches, denominations, and schools of thought, issued an open letter to the Pope elucidating what they termed to be the true teachings of Islam. A Common Word, issued exactly 1 year late after that, expanded upon the themes of the 2006 document. This new, much longer statement was signed by 138 Muslim scholars, clerics, intellectuals, each significant in stature and influence, and even more so than the list of signees of the earlier letter, together embodied the breadth of Islam, geographically, theologically, and otherwise. And yes, some of them were women. It has been claimed that with this document, leaders from all streams and expressions of Islam had come together for the first time since the days of the Prophet to declare the common ground between Christianity and Islam. A common word is indeed unique in its pan-Muslim sponsorship. If we take the trouble to understand who signed it, we have a better grip on Muslim diversity. The document makes 5 points. That the ground shared by Muslims and Christians is located in our respective scriptural mandates to love God and to love neighbor. That for Muslims, dialogue is a divine imperative. That Islam is not inherently anti-Christian. That exploration of our shared ground requires that we move beyond mere polite conversation to action in concert with each other. And that striving together for fairness, justice, and mutual goodwill is absolutely necessary for the welfare of the world. Much of the body of A Common Word is devoted to careful and detailed textual analysis of the Bible and the Quran in support of the contention that what Christians know as the Great Commandment, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength, is equivalent in meaning and import to what Muslims know as the best remembrance, there is no God but God, found among other places in the 48th chapter of the Quran, Al-Fath, verse 29. This argument is perhaps the most interesting and enlightening aspect of the whole document, in that it provides us Christians with a helpful opportunity to experience the Islamic exegetical process. Further, such a close reading of the Bible by Muslims implicitly encourages Christians to take up a close reading of the Quran. It is possible that Yale's Miroslav Volf has studied A Common Word between us and you more than any other single Christian theologian. He reminds us that while this document was a response to what many Muslims perceived as a Christian provocation, nevertheless the tone chosen for it was benevolent and beneficent rather than retaliatory. It has been said that God knows how to write straight, even on crooked lines, Volf notes. The signatories of A Common Word also wrote straight on the crooked lines of deep tensions. The whole Christian community, he says, indeed the whole world, should be grateful to them. A Common Word has sparked thoughtful responses from many quarters. Follow-up has come in the form of international conferences, doctoral dissertations, master's theses, commitments to regular symposia, and issuance of official statements. In a forthcoming article for Islam and Christian-Muslim Relations, a publication of the University of Birmingham, England, Ivan Haddad and Jane Smith of Georgetown and Harvard, respectively, trace the Christian literary responses to this document, which, as they see it, have fallen into 3 categories. In the first category, Smith and Haddad place responses such as the one crafted by Yale Divinity School scholars and endorsed subsequently by more than 300 Christian leaders, which stress the value of community, and thus are eager to affirm common ground and respond with enthusiasm to the call for dialogue. If Christians in the first category convey the gratitude Volf thinks is necessary, those in Haddad and Smith's second category decidedly do not. This is the category of negative voices, their complaints centering on issues of justice. Their typical objection? Why should we respond with enthusiasm to Muslims and create a safe space for Muslim voices when Christians are mistreated in Muslim lands? In the third category are responses which are wary, if not outright negative, and center on theological concerns. Those in this camp protest that the Muslims are setting the terms. They are calling for dialogue in a way that does not allow Christians not to respond gracefully, but neither does it allow Christians to respond as themselves. After all, those in this category protest. The very Quranic passage from which the title comes includes a dismissal of Trinitarian monotheism. But in actuality, A Common Word links the Muslim profession of the oneness of God not to a charge of Christian tritheism, but to the Great Commandment, which, as I see it, throws open the door for Christians to respond authentically in profoundly incarnational terms. Indeed, the open letter of reply from the Episcopal Church does just this. So I've suggested to Yvonne and Jane that perhaps the Episcopal Church's reply represents a fourth category. And we'll see it is mentioned in their article, which I haven't seen in its entirety. So we'll see where they place it. How have Muslims assessed a Common Word's impact? The February issue of Islamica, a beautiful journal out of Jordan, takes up this question in a 30-page collection of interviews and essays, a commentary. Most of the material in this dossier, they call it a Common Word dossier, the middle section here, I'll pass it around later. Many of these are papers from a conference in Rome, a Catholic-Muslim dialogue. Some of them come from other sources. There's also an interview with the Archbishop of Canterbury as the lead-off article in the section. We're going to look at three essays by Muslims that are included, and one by a Christian. This first one by Arif Ali Nayed of Cambridge University includes an enumeration of the reasons for a Common Word's importance. Among them, it is issued by and is addressed to leaders who collectively guide and influence millions. Two, it is grounded in dialogical scriptural reasoning. Three, it retrieves the gentle invitational mode of discourse that is founded in the true recognition of the other. Four, it retrieves a proper Muslim theology of gratitude, laying a solid foundation for grace-filled theology, teaching, and preaching that will result in grace-based actions in our troubled world. And five, it invokes key realities and notions that will be the seed for much more further elaboration. In his essay, Ibrahim Kalin of Georgetown University calls a Common Word a step toward recovery of the spirit of cosmopolitan Islam, in which a balance between recognizing the plurality of religious and cultural communities on the one hand and remaining loyal to one's own spiritual tradition on the other was the hallmark. A third essay, this one by Abdul Hakim Murad, also known as Tim Winter, Cambridge University, notes that response to a Common Word has not been universally rosy. It has been condemned by some Muslim voices, he notes, and some Christians have expressed their alienation from the warm and positive Christian responses that have come from Yale, Lambeth Palace, and other centers of Christian conscience. So he's confirming what Smith and Haddad have seen. Murad goes on to say, we need to acknowledge the other's fear of us. Each community has valid reasons to fear the other. Nevertheless, we are called, it is evident, to prove to the world that we are a force for good. In addition to the commentaries by Muslim scholars such as these three, the dossier includes a major paper by Miroslav Volf. Acknowledgement of significant common ground does not erase significant differences, Volf acknowledges. What does it do? It does this. It enables those of deep faith to respect and protect others despite these differences and helps them live together harmoniously, notwithstanding their differences. Neither does agreement on the dual commandment of love automatically resolve all of the practical problems causing tension between our two communities, Volf continues. What it does do is provide a basis on which we can productively discuss and overcome these conflicts. It encourages each community to hold the other accountable to its best insights and commitments. A common commitment to love of neighbor has real consequences on the ground. If practiced, it has the potential to diffuse many serious conflicts of global reach. It has this potential, Volf says, because love, properly understood, is not a soft and a nebulous emotion, but a tough, practical virtue of benevolence and beneficence towards all, a virtue of which justice is an absolutely integral part. Volf claims, and I concur, that commitment to the properly understood love of God and neighbor makes deeply religious persons, because they are deeply religious, into dedicated social pluralists. When Christians and Muslims commit themselves to practicing the dual command of love, they are not satisfying some private religious fancy. Instead, they are actively fostering conviviality in our eradicably pluralistic world that is plagued by deep divisions. They are making possible the constructive collaboration of people of different faiths in the common public space for the common good. And Christians do not have the corner on initiating multi-faith collaboration for our common good. Consider such Muslim-led projects as Eboo Patel's Interfaith Youth Corps or Kamran Mofid's endeavor known as Globalization for the Common Good. Those are just two. There are many others. Yes, a common word calls us to collaboration, but it also calls us to conversation, to dialogue. Many of us have been involved in Christian-Muslim dialogue for years. That's probably why you came to this instead of something else. Are there new ways to engage in light of this document? Allow me to offer two possibilities, and I'm sure we'll brainstorm more. My first suggestion comes from the multi-faith track of New York Theological Seminary's Doctor of Ministry program, for which I'm an instructor. Most of our students are Christian. This is an historically Baptist school. Its predecessor was the New York Bible Institute. And so we might define it as theologically conservative but socially progressive. And so we have this multi-faith track of our Doctor of Ministry program. Most of our students are Christian, but some are Jewish or Muslim. At the insistence of our president, Dale Irvin, a common word is an essential element in our first-year doctoral curriculum. Our students analyze this document and discuss what makes a word a common one. Eventually, they craft their own responses to the document. Such an approach could be used with interesting results as a retreat syllabus for an adult or teen forum, or with a several session discussion as a project of a local interfaith group. My second suggestion is that we take a closer look at the Building Bridges seminar. Founded in January 2002 by George Carey, then Archbishop of Canterbury, it has been sustained by his successor, Rowan Williams. This annual gathering brings together a diverse roster of some 20 to 40 Christian and Muslim scholars, an equal number of each. Participants are called to 3 full days of deliberation, each day addressing a particular theme related to the year's overarching topic by means of pairs of public lectures, closed plenary sessions, and work in pre-assigned small groups. Most years, the core activity has been intense discussion of pre-selected pairs of Bible and Quran texts. In 2004, the theme was Bearing the Word, Prophecy in Biblical and Quranic Perspective. For Muslims and Christians, one participant has noted, our mutual recognition of one another as people who bear within ourselves the transforming burden of the divine word is the surest ground on which to build friendship, trust, and cooperation. In preparation for the 2003 seminar, Scriptures in Dialogue, Christians and Muslims Studying the Bible and Quran Together, participants were asked to write a short response to the question, when, where, how, and with whom do I read Scripture? Think about that question. When, where, how, and with whom do I read Scripture? Many of these essays are quite moving. Taken together, they reveal a range of approach and multiple levels of engagement among members of each community of faith. I found those essays fascinating, and I found the question provocative, so I've assigned it on several occasions to groups of students. It's proved to produce a lot of head scratching and some pretty good essays on their part, too. I think it could be the seed for some really interesting, effective local dialogues. The 2006 meeting, Justice and Rights in Christian and Muslim Traditions, considered understandings of divine justice, political authority, and religious freedom. The 2005 meeting, Muslims, Christians, and the Common Good, addressed such concerns as faith and national identity, for we are both believers and citizens. Governance and justice, taking into account both majority and minority situations for Christians and Muslims, as well as the implications of secularism. And caring today for the world we share, a theme which concentrated on global poverty as well as environmental concerns. These topics can be taken up at the local or regional level, even by non-experts. In fact, I've participated in an ongoing dialogue that did just that in several cities over a period of time. these questions of how we understand key terms that come up in political discourse all the time are not scripture-driven conversations. We'll get to our scriptures, we'll get to our doctrines, our practices, but the conversation is being driven by terms we toss around all too easily all the time, or are tossed at us by the media. To sit down as a group of persons of faith, equal numbers of Muslims and Christians, and hash out what we mean by justice, by rule of law, by human rights. These are fascinating conversations. They can be replicated at the local level. The published digests of the first several years of the Building Bridges experiment provides Muslim and Christian leaders a program by which our congregations could work together quite fruitfully over time, perhaps covenanting to meet together 3 or 5 times, perhaps meeting weekly or monthly. There are many models for how to put it to practice in a way that makes sense where we are. However, in my own exploration of this, it seems to me that laypersons and local religious leaders might prefer a handbook format rather than a conference digest format, which guides them rather explicitly. Perhaps the development of such a handbook is a next step. It has been discussed at the international level, at least to some extent, and perhaps it will fall to some of us in the American context to actually produce them. Building Bridges meetings have been described as exercises in appreciative conversation, during which one remains rooted in one's background, all the while reaching beyond it. Appreciative conversation, distinguished as it is by courage, grace, imagination, and sensitivity in addressing and retreating from painful issues, is an exchange in which people listen without judgment, do not seek consensus or compromise, but share the sole purpose of continuing the conversation in order to sustain relationships of mutual respect. Rowan Williams has called it an exercise in listening to each other, listen to God, which enables us to become better able to listen to each other. Thus, we have, he suggests, a virtuous circle rather than a vicious one. This is what a common word calls for, a relationship which moves well beyond making nice. I have written at length elsewhere on what distinguishes dialogue from other forms of exchange. So have many others, including many Muslims. Mahmoud Ayoub comes to mind. But here I'm going to paraphrase a professor at St. Vladimir's Seminary who has said that dialogue is an arena in which we must practice the art of listening to others, but also where we must articulate our faith with clarity. Dialogue brings us face to face with folks whose view of the world differs radically from ours. In dialogue, we may well hear things that provoke us to delve more deeply into areas of our own faith that we had not considered before. Dialogue also provides Christians the opportunity to live up to the two-pronged command found in 1 Peter. Always be ready to give an explanation to anyone who asks you for a reason for your hope, but give it with courtesy and respect. This command requires that Christians be clear in advance about our convictions. It also suggests the need for a positive theology of religious diversity. The Christian theology of the religious other that I advocate personally is one which emphasizes God's radical generosity, the wideness of God's mercy, and which I believe is indeed biblical. How so? Here are the stepping stones I often walk congregations through. According to Genesis 1, a good place to start, all of humanity, has been created in God's image and after God's likeness. Then there's the prophet Isaiah, who in chapter 42 tells us that he speaks on behalf of God the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and what comes from it, who gives breath to the people upon it and spirit to those who walk in it. That is, God gives all of this to all of humanity. As Christians, we insist on describing the one and only Creator in triune terms. That is, we understand the one and only God to be relationship itself. For us, the very life of God is a being with, we celebrate Emmanuel, God with us, God with all of creation. God, Emmanuel, God with us, is he who told us that the greatest commandment is to love God and neighbor. Emmanuel is he who defined neighbor in the story of the Good Samaritan in terms of one who makes a claim on us by virtue of his or her nearness. The neighbor is the one who demands that we be with. When we are commanded to love God and to love our neighbors as ourselves, we are in effect commanded to be with our neighbors. And when we are being with neighbors whose religions are different from ours, we are given the opportunity to eavesdrop on their own dialogue with the divine. More could be said about such eavesdropping, but for now, we move on to the ninth commandment, which orders us not to bear false witness against our neighbor. We'll be hard-pressed to bear accurate witness to the neighbor, the religion of our neighbor, if we have little sense of what that religion is really about. Wesley R. A. Raja, who grew up a Methodist Christian in the midst of Hindus, insists that if we refuse to take the religious life of our neighbor seriously, if we misrepresent it, our own life is distorted and diminished. Certainly, we can be of better service, more loving, more respectful of dignity, more likely to establish justice and peace if we bring to that effort an understanding of how our neighbor establishes, maintains, and celebrates a meaningful world, which is how I define religion itself. I stand with the well-known evangelical Tony Campolo, who encourages us to revisit the description of Judgment Day in Matthew 25. Then ask ourselves if our neighbors of another religion have fed the hungry and clothed the naked. To Christians who respond, sure they have, but they don't have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ and there's no salvation without that, Campolo argues, oh, but they have had a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Recall, Campolo says, that according to Matthew 25, anyone who cares for the least of these has taken care of Christ's very self. Hands-on care for Christ trumps any claims of allegiance we may have. Jesus himself says, Campolo reminds us, on Judgment Day there will be many people who will say, when did we have this wonderful relationship with you? We're not sure we know who you are. And Jesus will explain to them, well, you didn't know it was I, but when you did it to the least of these, it was doing it to me. With all of this in mind, admittedly, my eschatology leans more toward universalism than particularism. I embrace the notion found in Ephesians and explicated by Irenaeus of anencephalosis, gathering up, recapitulation, the end shall resemble the beginning. That is, God is drawing all of creation to God's self through Christ. Read Revelation more carefully, urges my own theology professor Christopher Morse. In the end, even hell itself will be cast into the lake of fire. And yes, I know that there are a great many Christians whose theology of the end is much more exclusivist than this. Yet I insist no matter how particular our attitude may be regarding the economy of salvation, the mandate to neighborliness, to hospitality, is incumbent on all Christians. When it comes to the Great Commission, I think it's helpful to keep the golden rule in mind. Treat others as you wish to treat, as you would wish others to treat you. Speak to others about your religion in a manner, in a tone of voice, that you would have them speak to you about theirs, and speak about theirs in a manner you would hope that they would speak about yours. I was asked to talk about possibilities and limits of common words. As you've probably discerned, I'm less inclined to dwell on the limits as to rejoice in the possibilities. The pluralism I encourage is defined in terms of delighting in the differences, even the deepest ones. I'm often asked why I do or how I came to do what I do, and I think it comes from growing up in a family that had to move every few years, including halfway through seventh grade and just before the final semester of high school. I learned how to navigate difference, how to be the odd person out, how to overcome shyness, and I think that's why I have the vocation of helping others navigate religious difference, of being the one to hold your hand when you walk into difference. And I found that it's really a delightful enterprise, that understanding the differences is ever so much as interesting as finding the common ground. And yet there is common ground. We do need to stand on that, or we can't understand each other at all. And so I think that pluralism, best understood, is the encounter of commitments. I encounter my Muslim friends, my Zoroastrian friends, my Sikh friends, as the Episcopalian I am. And they know that. They know I'm going to stay that, but they delight in my willingness to understand who they are. So it's also about becoming theologically and religiously multilingual, which is Martin Forward's term. But it's so necessary to become religiously multilingual so we can bear truthful witness about our neighbors, and also so we just don't spend so much time talking and energy, talking past each other. Delighting in the differences, embracing pluralism as I define it, is also about recognizing the transformative power of the act of listening to those whose commitments and convictions differ from ours. And I'd love to entertain your questions at this time. Yes.
I don't know where this came from, but I've been wondering the tension in the Middle East. Are there any dialogues between the Jews and the Muslims?
There are. I can't speak to them with any specificity because it's outside my particular area of expertise. I can share one. I do research for the Center for Multifaith Education at Auburn Seminary. Auburn has an initiative which I always mess up the name of. It's face-to-face, or else it's the other way around. It brings together young people, Jews and Muslims, Arabs and Israelis, and other across other differences as well. But they started with that. So there's a ground-up initiative. There are others like that one. John, you want to? Yeah.
Sure. Rabbi David Rosen, who's affiliated with the American Jewish Committee and headquartered in Israel, has a rabbis and imams meeting that he promotes. So he brings rabbis and imams together. They meet around the Middle East in various locations. The problem is this. At Tantur Ecumenical Institute, in Israel on the road to Bethlehem, has given up on this because the Muslim representatives often come from the territories and go through the degradation of passing through the checkpoints, these high-tech checkpoints that our U.S. government helped fund. And they don't come as equals then. They have to go through and go through all kinds of scrutiny and everything else to meet with Jewish representatives in the territories. And Israelis cannot go to the territories. They're prohibited from going into Bethlehem. Some people do it, particularly a Jesuit Israeli citizen who teaches at Bethlehem University knows a way to get around it, but
it's so dangerous.
It's a real problem. The political climate prohibits it in Israel. So in this way, it's kind of hard to say, well, what about that along there? Got to go on. People like David Rosen is trying.
Yeah. This leads me to think there's another way that this very problem is being attacked, and it's addressed is a better word. And it's in this country. There is a project of twinning of synagogues and mosques, and a prominent mosque, or maybe the only mosque in town, depending on where you are, and a synagogue agree to form a relationship and work together on hard questions. The more that happens in this country, the more generous, even-handed, I believe, our foreign policy will be able to become, because we will know each other better. That's a really important step. I have to tell you, the largest mosque in New York City, we affectionately call it the 96th Street Mosque, is so thrilled to be a mosque paired with a prominent synagogue in New York City. And really interesting things are happening. The imam goes regularly to Jewish Theological Seminary and meets with the seminarians there. That was not happening even 2 years ago.
And project or website?
Yeah, I look, Google for mosque synagogue twinning, and you'll find things. Twinning.
Did you say that the face-to-face and faith-to-faith program is at Auburn University?
Auburn Theological Seminary.
Yeah,
Auburn.
Question at any time.
Sure.
At Auburn University. Alabama, Department of Religious Studies, Richard Penascovic, does a lot of work in writing. Friend of mine. He has written a recent paper talking about the life of Fethullah Gulen.
Fethullah Gulen.
Yeah. And what, can you shed any light on
sure.
his effort in terms of, for example, the Common Word?
Yes. If you had told me when I moved to New York to do doctoral work in the mid-90s, that I would become really famous in Turkey, I would have laughed. But that's what has happened. Pardon me?
You went on one of those sponsored trips?
No, but what I did do was insist on earning a doctorate in Christian-Muslim relations in an Episcopal seminary instead of a university. And I had my reasons. I really thought it was there was something significant about studying somebody else's religion in immersed in the context of my own faith, and so I wanted to do that, and they let me out, which is even more important. And the way that it was possible to pull this off was that I needed a Muslim to be an external advisor to my dissertation. My best friend in the academy was too busy, but so he paired me up with a Turkish ethicist, and he's based in Ankara. He's now the government's deputy for dealing with all Turkish students who study in who study abroad. So he does a lot of running around. His name is Ibrahim Öztemir, and he's well published in the area of Muslim concerns about the environment. The deal was he'd work with me on my dissertation if I would promise to stir Bediüzzaman Said Nursi into it somehow. And all of the followers of Bediüzzaman Said Nursi who are part of this, there are several streams, but there's a very well-funded stream that pays attention to Nursi's works, was thrilled that a Christian was willing to analyze his material, pay attention to the supplications he prayed, write about all of that. So I've gone back and forth to Turkey on a number of occasions to talk, to give papers on Nursi. On one of these occasions, the Gulen folks, who are ubiquitous in this country, found out that I was going over, and they facilitated a side trip to Konya and to Cappadocia, and I could have gone with them numerous other times. My schedule's pretty tight. I just couldn't go. But they are very generous. I work with their centers in New York and New Jersey quite a bit. And there's an article in the pipeline somewhere where I've written about what Gulen has meant by dialogue and whether it measures up to most people's definitions of dialogue. But it's a word he uses quite a bit. It's a word he likes the notion of tolerance quite a bit. The difference between Nursi and Gulen is this. They both draw upon Rumi for nurture. There's a Naqshbandi influence there too, so a heavy Sufi influence. Nursi would never have allowed anyone to call him a Sufi. Gulen might, and it has to do with everything with the changing political times. But they are both very definitely mystics. Nursi was a sheikh, a spiritual leader who produced 5,000 pages of text, most of it Quran commentary, some of it letters. Gulen is an educator and an entrepreneur and businessman, and his legacy will be schools all over the place, really excellent schools. They're not Islamic schools. They're schools founded by Muslims, and there's a huge difference in that what's taught in the ones that I've visited is your basic curriculum with a very heavy emphasis on math and science. In the New York Gulen schools, which take various names, they don't usually have his name involved in them at all, but you tease through a few layers and you find out that they're inspired by him or by his thinking. in the New York ones, the ones in Brooklyn, the children all instruction is done in English, and they all learn Turkish, but they also all learn Spanish. So here's a Turkish founded school in New York insisting everybody learn Spanish. Why? Because we expect our graduates to become good business persons, and Spanish is a language of commerce these days. If you want to have a business in New York, you ought to know Spanish. If you want to have a business in Texas, you ought to have Spanish. And by the way, they're present in a number of cities in Texas as well. So Guylaine's project of outreach to Christians is an interesting one. It's also complex because you'll find a situation where you'll find some Turkish Americans who suddenly express a real interest in your particular church, and that'll go on for a while, and then they'll just kind of drop you because they've become fascinated with some other church down the block. So, you know, don't take it personally. It happens all the time. but I think they are well-meaning. John's got a project going. The Rumi Forum at Georgetown is a Gulen-inspired series of lectures. There are many of such series of gatherings that go on around the country. Really good stuff. So I would encourage you to say yes if they invite you to their events. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Jewish and Muslim sites, and then they even arranged private meetings with the chief rabbi of Turkey and also of the
Patriarch. Yep. And they do a pretty good job. Sometimes it depends on who your guide is. Sometimes they're less able to emphasize to meet the theological and biblical concerns that the Christians want met on such a trip. But often they have done a really fine job. I have numerous friends who've gone. Yeah, go ahead.
First question, where can we get the current document?
A Common Word?
Yeah.
acommonword.com. I'm pretty sure that's right. acommonword.com. We'll take you to the official website. You can download the actual text. You can also download many of the responses. The Episcopal Church's response is not on there. You can get it from our website. You can also get it from me. And I'm very happy to entertain questions and share stuff. And there was supposed to be a thing to write on, but there isn't. So you just have to listen carefully. LucindaMosher@earthlink.net. LucindaMosher@earthlink.net. And I'll send you the text of the Episcopal
Church also has made a response.
Yep.
It's not on the website either.
Do you have access to that one? Yeah. So we can get these out to you. Yes.
You might also point out all that you find there because you find the history of the document.
Yep. Yeah. I was going to say that it's a fascinating site because you'll find the document. Frequently asked questions, you know, how did it come to be? Why was such a thing needed? That kind of stuff. Lots of responses to it. Just a wealth of material. Who's writing their master's thesis on it? Just lots and lots of good stuff. And your second question, you have.
How is this being received in the political arena? Is this something just kind of between quote unquote Christian Muslims in a religious venue, or is it being somehow interpreted over into policy? You know, when you raise the topic about justice, you know, all kinds of cultural religious things come into play. There's the role of women, honor killings, and you know, all sorts of stuff. Is this beginning to get play in the political arena somehow?
Well, I think it's very definitely a document by religious leaders to religious leaders claiming we have considerable influence as religious leaders on the ground and therefore in the political arena. If we were to understand each other better and work therefore more closely together, we could affect change. Some of the concerns you're raising are so multi-leveled, it would take me much more time than we have to address what language we should even use to express our perceived concerns, because it's not multivalent. It's not univalent. It's really complicated. It's interesting for me, and again, I specialize more in the U.S. context than the international one. It's interesting to me to hear imams who are dealing with a congregation that's mostly one ethnic group say to them, you've got to get over this notion that Pakistani culture is the real deal for Islam. It's, you know, you're practicing Pakistanism, not Islam. We need to help you practice Islam. Let go of the ethnic cultural stuff that you've accrued to your religion, and also be willing to worship across ethnic lines, especially in the large cities where it's possible to split off ethnically. There's a real push by the leaders who would embrace a common word as Muslim leaders to say to their constituency, come on, we need to understand ourselves, each other, better, and then we also need to understand our neighbor better.
I'm involved in Jewish-Christian-Muslim dialogue in Mobile, but we only have a handful of Muslims, primarily Turks, as far as the Middle East, because the vast majority of Muslims that I would come into contact with, that I have come in contact with, are black Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
What is their theological response? Mind you, I haven't had a chance to talk to any imams. And other kinds of encounters. What is the general black Muslim take on this doctrine?
That's a good question, and I would have to research it. But here's my guess, is that that there were few, if any, African American Muslim leaders who were called up especially to sign on in that initial 138. There probably are some who are in the larger the post signing list, and we have to again be careful of our terms, because black Muslim connotes to me Nation of Islam, the Farrakhan movement, which is closer to Sunni Islam than it used to be, but it still is pretty much its own thing. And African American Muslims with whom I work are real clear they are Sunni Muslims. And there would be, and they are involved deeply in organizations like ISNA and ICNA, which were signees to this document. And so from their perspective, their voice is represented in the signing. They would prefer to have been asked to be part of the crafting, because they believe they are the indigenous Muslim presence here, and why is it we don't listen to them more? Most African American Muslims in America today are Sunni Muslims in fellowship with Warith Deen Muhammad of blessed memory. They do not get the same level of press as the Farrakhan movement to this day. If someone wants a soundbite from an African American Muslim, the journalists tend still to go to Farrakhan instead of to the much larger community. So there's nothing in this document they wouldn't say amen to. Many of them probably have signed on. I would just have to check for sure. And they are engaged in the organizations that I know for sure have been involved in it.
A while back, I was in Santa Fe and just stumbled on a very interesting dialogue between two women, both of them. Whose roots were in Islam, one who had made the decision to leave Islam, one taught at Columbia University, both of them were under guard 24 hours, 7 days a week, because of the work that they were seeking to do to reform. One had decided to leave Islam. But there was a lot that evening with which they agreed in their dialogue with each other, but when it came to a discussion about whether violence was systemic to Islam or to a patriarchal culture that predates Islam. There was strong disagreement, each taking one of those positions. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if in your dialogue and what have you discovered about that question, that issue of jihad or violence as part of the Islamic way itself, or is it a reflection of culture that predates?
My jihad is to help you understand your Muslim neighbor better. The word means struggle. It does not mean holy war. It does not mean violence. It means struggle. Historically, it has always had multiple uses. The use, as I just used it, it's the struggle to be a better person, the interior struggle. There are some early uses of the word where it is armed resistance to attack. Historically, it was not meant to be an aggressive behavior. It's not, jihad and domestic violence have nothing to do with each other. That the word is not used to describe, to denote domestic violence. Domestic violence is a real issue, and I imagine that's where these two women were. That was part of the discussion you're referencing. The Muslims that I know best believe with all their heart and soul and strength and mind that the Quran does not condone domestic violence, does not condone gratuitous violence of any sort, and they work hard on that within the Muslim community. Where there is domestic violence, but there's domestic violence in the Christian community too, in every community. It's an equal opportunity curse, you know. And so here are groups that work on the kinds of issues you're raising, and they work on it from the belief, the conviction, the deep conviction that Islam is the way of peace and honor and moving toward the good and the beautiful, the doing of the beautiful, that Islam is about normative practices, normative behavior, theology, normative doctrinal concepts, but undergirding it all is Islam, the doing of the beautiful. So I would point you to Karama, the Muslim Women Lawyers for Human Rights. They're based in D.C. I point you to Word, WORDE, that's trying to overcome issues such as we're talking about, but many others, one Islamic community at a time. I would point you to Turning Point for Women and Families, a social service agency in Jamaica, Queens, that works specifically on domestic violence. I have heard the 26-year-old imam of the New York Police Department speak at a Turning Point fundraising iftar, fast-breaking dinner, and move that gathering to tears as he, 26 years old and preaching extemporaneously, said in many colorful and memorable ways, how can you look at the Prophet's example, and who never abused a woman, and think that it would ever be appropriate to lay a hand on a woman? How could you ever think that you have the license to hit a woman? And you know, I think that's the hope of the future, at least in the United States, that there are young men as well as young women working on the doing of the beautiful as a core Muslim concept. Yeah.
I was a Roman Catholic respondent to the document locally here with a delegation from Kosovo, and there was about 14 from Kosovo imams and just Muslim laity, but it was the most difficult dialogue I had ever been engaged in my life.
Yeah.
Particularly as you talk about the universal, it's very easy to talk in those ambiguous categories of neighbor and God. My understanding of the universal is defined by the particular.
Mm-hmm.
So in the dialogue, when you dig deeply about the nature of the person of Christ as the lens upon which I come to the possibility of even beginning to understand what neighbor looks like in and through the eyes of God, and the challenge that reveals to me, it moves beyond the subjectivity of something that you just said about the Muslims that you know or a friend of yours believe that this or that is what the Quran represents. But when you engage in a dialogue and ask, well, who defines who neighbor is, you know, we both hold to these things of God and neighbor, it moves for me as a person rooted in a tradition and needing to operate out of that particularity as a way of defining the universal and being challenged by that as well. It becomes a real struggle even in recognizing that we're just doing this out of a dialogue of trust and charity so we could know each other's positions, but it became very defensive, and it's almost as if we weren't prepared with the basic principles that you brought forward of what is appropriate dialogue in this context. What is the nature of interreligious dialogue? And what are the boundaries, and what are we willing to hear and not hear in each other's traditions that can help us move forward? Because until you really know who I am and how Christ is the organizing principle of my life, then it's impossible for me to talk adequately about God or neighbor.
Exactly. And I think that's why when I talk about the Gulen movement, what he means by dialogue and what I mean by dialogue are two quite different things, because for me, dialogue is a process and it will be painful. Most of what we experience is not dialogue, it's encounter. We are just getting our feet wet and it's time to go our separate ways. Dialogue, working through the kinds of things you're saying, it takes time, patience, and commitment. I think one of the things that you're saying that resonates for me is that notion of what are we willing to hear about the other? How much of the other's religion are we willing to hear that may challenge our preconceived notions about that other religion? And it works both ways, but I'm more concerned about the behavior of my fellow Christians. So when they dismiss Muhammad out of hand and don't understand that for a Muslim, and let me give you an example. I have a acquaintance in Dearborn where I teach who is a critical care nurse, and she worked with cancer patients in one of the major Detroit hospitals for years, and she's doing really hard work as a third generation Arab American, and she speaks the language fluently so she can work with the immigrant community there easily when they're dying. And she says, when I'm doing this work, when I'm holding up the infant of an Iraqi woman who's just given birth to a child that has no nose and mouth, but whose heart is still beating, and I say, I have to be the hands of tenderness for this child and help this mother through this terrible birth, I am being the arms and legs and hands and heart of Muhammad. Doesn't that sound an awful lot like what we mean when we say we are being the body of Christ? That for Muslims, it's not that different. But I can't tell you how many classrooms full of seminarians have resisted the idea that there could be a resonance there, because they've come with a notion of Muhammad that's ugly. It takes a lot of undoing to notice that there's so much to the legacy of the prophet that gives impetus to the doing of the beautiful. And so that's a challenge, because we don't want to hear it. We don't want to hear that verse 434 doesn't necessarily translate as it's okay to hit your wife. It doesn't. It some people insist on interpreting it that way, but there are other interpretations, 34 of them. You know, and so, you know, it's tough work. It's tough work among Muslims. It's even tougher work across the religious lines. That's why Miroslav Volf is such an interesting voice. Because think of his context. He He comes from Croatia. He survived all of what went on in that part of the world. So does my good friend Samir Selmanovic, who is a Muslim convert to Christianity and has founded a project in New York called Faith House, where he said, I want a church where Christians aren't in charge. So he's the Christian leader, but there's also a Muslim leader and a Jewish leader, and they hold gatherings on Saturday afternoons or evenings. They share, it's mostly 30s and 40-somethings. You can look for Faith House Manhattan to find the project. And the hope is that this will become a model for other faith houses around the country. But he does this out of his experience of finding Christ and believing that this was a better path for him than his somewhat secular Muslim upbringing. And when his parents went ballistic over his choice, who was it that settled them down on his behalf? The local imam, who said, he's following God. What more would you want? Let him be. That there is this possibility. There are so many people who don't want to hear that story. But part of dialogue is learning to listen. It's a huge part of dialogue, and that takes time. And so I don't doubt that because the defensiveness, you mentioned the defensiveness, that comes up a lot because, especially in this country, Muslims have felt beaten down and beaten back in so many ways. They're humiliated in so many ways, those who are obvious about their faith. And it's tough. I'm going from this conference directly to Washington, D.C. to a meeting at Virginia Seminary on empowering the next generation of interfaith leaders, and it will be equal numbers of Christians and Muslims gathered, as far as I know. And some of those Muslims I know personally to have been through a lot in the last 5-7 years. And they will be defensive, but they will also know that those of us gathered with them in the room understand why that is. Yeah.
The breadth of the 138 signers of the Common Prayer document is pretty impressive. The impression I have is that the Christian responses have been rather fractured, denominationally, nationally. What kinds of efforts were made to have a multinational, pan-Christian response?
I don't know, except for the Yale one. I don't know of anyone and that would have been Miroslav Volf's initiative. I don't know of anybody who's tried to do an international pan-Christian response. The Yale one is sort of an effort in that way. It's got well over 300 signees now, and you know, maybe more, because they're not too good at keeping up the website and adding the names. The problem with that is that it was done hurriedly and then asked for sign-on, so it wasn't necessarily a process of vetting through the Episcopal Church, the Methodist Church, the Disciples of Christ, and on it goes. And then, you know, how do we get the independent churches, the vast number of Christians that aren't under any of these nice, neat umbrellas, to feel that document speaks for them too? It's really tricky. The Anglican Communion's process in coming up with a document of response was that really quickly, Rowan Williams wrote a short piece that said, "I hear you. I'm thankful that you included me in your list of named signees, and I'll get back to you." I mean, it was just pretty much essentially that. And then he sent out a memo to through his office, did through a number of sources. I got the memo because I help in very modest ways with the Network of Interfaith Concerns of the Anglican Communion. So I was asked to provide some input. So was our ecumenical office. So were officers of many, many other Anglican provinces around the globe. And then what was sent in by the end of February of that year was read by that office, and I'm not sure at all how they decided what to use and what not, but it's the document that comes out of it at least input was invited from around the globe, and I know some input was received from around the globe. So that's one branch of Christianity.
Many denominations.
Yeah. So it's one branch of Christianity, but many. Many expressions of it around the globe at least contributed to the crafting of that document in some small way. So those are the only two I know of that really, and I'm sure the Catholic response, you want to speak to the Catholic response?
Well, I don't know if the text really is meant to generate responses as far as like
special letters.
BDM generated responses as a consensus document, but rather, what are we going to do with this? And I think what we've come to see in the last 2 years is that text represents a momentum shift. That for 40 years, Christian institutions, and modestly I'd say primarily the Vatican, have been the engine driving Christian-Muslim relations. But suddenly now, an initiative from the Muslim world, from the center, and as part of an attempt to capture back the voice of Islam in the media, representing the heart of the tradition and a consensus. And they did consensus on fatwas and who can declare someone a Muslim and all these things until they got to this point. That there's been a momentum shift. And now Muslims from the heart of Islam, from the center, from the kingdom of Jordan, and the Saudis got involved as well. You know, we got to do something. They threw a lot of money at a multi-faith, a couple of them.
Yep,
but also bringing their scholars into the ring to issue some judgments on pluralism and dialogue. It represents a shift from the Muslim world is now inviting Christians to dialogue. And let's see where this goes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's going on.
Yeah.
And so I think thinking creatively, well, what's the next step? How can we take this goodwill and move with it? And some of the things that have been suggested by the Senate, especially this kind of sharing scripture,
mm-hmm.
read scripture together, these kinds of things can come out of this. So I think
yeah.
that's more important.
It
seems to me like we come off looking like we haven't gone very far in Christian unity.
Yeah.
That we're just so fractured that they can speak to us in a more dynamic way than we can speak.
Yeah.
I don't
think so because it's again, it took a lot of effort. They know how much work it took to get 138 people to the table to sign that document. I mean, that was not an easy thing to pull off. And they're more willing to admit their own fractured nature than they used to be. But I want to pick up on what John said about a couple of things. One is that Jay Rock yesterday made the point that one of the most important things Colleen said in his essay about the import of this document from a Muslim point of view is that it's a retrieval of good stuff that's gotten overrun by the loudness of the very extreme right of Islam on the ground and in the media. It's a retrieval of a voice and an effort and an attitude. And guess what? Those negative responses that Haddad and Smith noted are really uncomfortable with the fact that the playing field has shifted and the Muslims are the ones calling for the dialogue because they want to set all the terms. And they're uncomfortable with the Muslims setting the terms and immediately say, oh, well, they're not going to let us be ourselves. Well, doggone it, I wasn't going to stand for that. I wrote a piece that's deliberately incarnational and Trinitarian in response, and so did Rowan Williams. The other thing is, I think you'd be interested to know that this Virginia Seminary gathering that's happening Thursday night, Friday, and Saturday, why did I get invited? Not because of who I am and what I do, although that would have seemed logical. No, because they asked some prominent Muslims to come to the table and said, okay, here's our invitation list. Who's missing? Who do you think should be here with you? And Debbie Almentazer said Lucinda should be here. And they said, okay. And the email went out. I'm there because Muslims want me there. That's the kind of momentum shift that John is talking about. That's the kind of difference I have seen in the last several years. I'm on conference calls with Muslims who are planning how they're going to meet with Mayor Bloomberg next and what kind of agenda, not because I'm going to add any wisdom, but just because I'm on the phone listening to them matters to them. That's a shift. That's the shift in the playing field. I want to get a hand that hasn't been asked. Yeah, go ahead. And this may be our last one. I don't know. We'll see.
I really appreciate what you've been saying. So often it seems to me that ecumenical and interfaith dialogue go on, you know, at a level that, you know, jurisdictory, theological. You know, right now with the politics of our world, this dialogue, I think we have to help get this awareness to some political leaders, some moral leaders, who are affecting our lives and the lives of people in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And how do I start to reach that?
Well, and I think we can work from the bottom up. We may not be able to do so much from the top down, but look at the Muslims and Christians who are insisting that Mayor Bloomberg pay more attention to his Muslim and his Arab constituencies in New York. That's a bottom up thing. I don't know what the issues are in your town, but whatever they are, there's a way that there can be a multi-faith effort to see that the political leaders pay attention to all of their constituents. And that may be the way forward, because eventually it bubbles up far better than it trickles down. I really appreciated your questions. I am going to be here through the early part of lunch tomorrow. I'd love to talk with more of you individually and email. I'm also available to come to where you are if that would be helpful. Thank you so much.